plumes and feathers. Just what is this versatile appendage made of? At its core, both upper and lower halves of a beak contain light, bony projections that extend from the skull. These bony parts are covered with a sheath of a tough material called keratin. It's the same stuff that makes up tortoise shells, the scales and claws of reptiles, and our own hair and fingernails. The keratin sheath makes the beak tough, durable, and shiny. The sheath grows continuously because a beak wears down with use. Picture a shorebird, like this black oyster catcher, flipping rocks and hammering shells all day. Ancient birds were weighed down with jaws and teeth, making flight far more challenging. But the beak of a modern bird, whether it belongs to an eagle, toucan, or hummingbird, is a marvel fit for life on the wing. For BirdNote, I'm Mary McCann. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Welcome to Scream Therapy. I'm your host, Jason Schurz. In October of 2018, I found myself in the hospital, sitting across from a psychiatrist who was telling me I had bipolar. I was sent home with a bunch of medication and laid on the couch for a week. I had my iTunes library on shuffle, trying to shake the hornet's nest from my head. Ever since I was a kid, I've been using loud music as a form of therapy. Punk rock and mental health have always been connected. This podcast looks at that connection through the lens of different guests. This is Scream Therapy. Like most mental health conditions, obsessive-compulsive disorder is perpetually misunderstood. The letters OCD immediately bring to mind uncontrollable hand-washing or flicking light switches a certain amount of times before leaving a room. The reality is there are countless versions of what OCD looks like, and it presents differently in different people. Solo artist Lindsay Troy, formerly of garage rock duo Deep Valley, is speaking up about the OCD she's dealt with for decades. Lindsay was caught in a vicious cycle of intrusive thoughts and compulsive behavior. The more she engaged in the thoughts, the worse it got. Eventually, she entered an inpatient program and started learning exposure and response prevention therapy. By challenging intrusive thoughts that trick her into thinking she's in danger, Lindsay is breaking the cycle of obsession and compulsion.
My name is Lindsay Troy. I'm a musician and an artist, a songwriter, singer, performer. I perform under my name. I was in a band called Deep Valley for many years, which is a duo with me and another woman. And we toured and played all around the world for many years. And then we disbanded about a year or two ago, and now I'm doing solo music. I was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder when I was 14 years old, and I'm 39 now. So it's something I've lived with for the majority of my life now. And it's been a long, difficult journey living with it. But I'm just opening up about it for the first time right now with the release of the single I just put out because it was inspired by that.
So OCD is a very misunderstood condition because there's just so many different kinds and everybody's experience is different, obviously. I live with bipolar and I know a lot of bipolar folks who have completely different experiences than I do. But OCD in particular is quite involved because of all different subsets and kinds. So can you maybe explain what OCD looks like to you?
Sure. Well, it can really change. It's been an ever-evolving thing. I mean, really, OCD is obsessive compulsive disorder. So you have obsessions, you have these intrusive thoughts in the brain that cause distress or discomfort. And then the compulsions are something that you feel like you have to do to stop the obsessive thoughts. But it's a really vicious cycle that only makes it worse if you do the compulsions. And it has changed a lot over the years. It has looked very different and has included very different sets of behaviors. And every day is a new trigger pops up. So people think of OCD as like having a really clean house. So I have an example, like that's kind of funny. I mean, my house is a total mess right now. I have two kids. I have a 2-year-old who's almost 3 and I have a 6-year-old. And I actually feel for me that it's actually harder to keep my house clean because everything feels extra hard and extra challenging for me. Like folding laundry, I feel like takes forever because, you know, I want everything to be folded perfectly and it's like an exposure for me to not have to fold it perfectly. So I reconnected with an old friend recently from high school and she's been coming to my house. She's a flight attendant and she stops in LA. She came to my house and she was really sweet. She was helping me tidy up a little bit because she could tell I was like a little overwhelmed with my, you know, small children and my life and stuff. So she was helping me fold laundry and I was like, you know, I told her, I was like, I have OCD. She's like, how can you be OCD? Your house is messy. And I was like, well, that's the misconception about OCD. Like just because you have a clean, you want your house to be clean. I mean, everyone wants their house to be clean, but it's much more nuanced and totally freaking bizarre than that.
Yeah.
And anyone who has it knows that. And anyone who's close to someone with OCD knows that it can be totally bizarre. It can be about intrusive thoughts can be about anything. Like, yes, the stereotypical things are about like germs and hand washing or maybe like light switching.
Yeah.
But it can be about superstitious stuff. It can be about symmetry. It can be about like letters or numbers or dates. Mine, like I said, it hasn't looked one way for the last, you know, 25 years.
Yeah.
It's changed a lot. So I'll overcome one thing and then the next day a new thing comes up for me to obsess about and have to work on.
I have a family member who's actually in the middle of an OCD crisis right as we speak, which has been really tough.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Thanks. The way that they describe it, that made a lot of sense to me because I don't live with it myself, is that it's almost like a mental hoarding. Like they have to hoard all this information and basically becomes like big piles of information that have become overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And also like a librarian who is in like the messiest library that makes no sense and is trying to make sense of it all. And that really helped me understand what they're going through. Does that ring true for you at all?
I think I know what they're talking about. It depends where you're at with your OCD. Like it sounds like if you are engaging in a lot of the compulsions, it's like feeding the bear. So the more you engage in them, the worse it gets and the more you're going to be hoarding. So I can see what they're talking about. I've done exposure and response prevention, which is what they call the gold standard of care for OCD. And I didn't start that until I was pregnant with my first child, because that was like a breaking point for me when I had been off my medication and things were very stressful and hormonal changes. And I knew that I really had to get my life together at that point because I was going to have a kid. But that's when you basically are exposed to your triggers and It's the response prevention. So you don't do the compulsion. And with repetition, eventually the anxiety is supposed to go down. But it feels like, I said recently, like you're actively marching towards your doom. Like it feels like, why would I choose to actively do the thing that I've spent endless hours and endless effort and stress trying to avoid, and then I'm just going to go actively do that and ruin my life? Like, that's what it feels like you're going to ruin the rest of your life. But that's the lie that OCD tells you, and that's the lie that OCD tells me every day. Like, every time a trigger comes up, my therapist says OCD is a con artist, and that is a really good way to explain OCD. So it's the intrusive thoughts that come into my brain that don't even, sometimes they make sense, but sometimes they're totally bizarre and it's really stupid. It just latches onto any dumb old thing it can think of. So I thought I would do this today. I'm doing an exposure right now. So I'm wearing this shirt that has two buttons and one of the loops broke off. And so I can't button the top button. So my brain told me, well, it's bad to wear that shirt today. And it will do that a lot. Like, it'll just say something's bad.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why is it bad? Well, because it's, I don't know, because I guess because it's broken, and that symbolically is a bad thing. And for me to be wearing this during an important interview where I'm opening up about OCD for the first time, well, you know, I'm ruining it by doing that. And I'm always going to remember that for the rest of my life. I'll still be thinking about this on my deathbed, that I messed this interview up. So that's the lie that the OCD tells you, right?
Yeah.
But if you feed the bear, it gets worse.
I think I understand what you're talking about with the exposure therapy and how important it is to fight against that and wear the shirt, because, you know, otherwise it becomes an obsession. And I guess I'm wondering what would happen if you were to not wear the shirt and sort of feed that intrusive thought. Would it just kind of spiral into more intrusive thoughts, or?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's no saying exactly what could happen, but there's no winning with OCD. Whenever you feed it, whenever you do a compulsion, you don't win. The OCD wants you to be stuck in a constant state of uncertainty or distress. So maybe it just wants me to have not done the interview and, like, have me changing shirts 100 times, and I can't figure out what to wear, and everything seems bad and weird. And then I end up sabotaging it because no outfit feels right or something. But I'll give an example. One thing that brought me a lot of joy in my life throughout my youth and my teenage years was thrift store shopping and vintage clothes. It's something I've always really loved. And that was something when my OCD was really bad for a number of years, that was something that was kind of robbed from me. I stopped wearing vintage clothes and thrift store clothes because I thought, it's kind of convoluted and hard to explain, but I thought that they were, like, creepy or might have bad energy on them, or I didn't know the history of them and maybe they'd been in a creepy place before, or someone had been murdered in them or something. I don't know, you know? So that was a trigger for me, and that was something it was kind of sad. Like, I caved to it, and I didn't really wear vintage clothes or thrift store clothes for years. And then I, like, lost a part of myself that was really important to me. I really liked expressing myself through cool, interesting clothes and vintage shopping. And I would get too creeped out going into the vintage stores and touching stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But recently I have started to wear the vintage clothes again, go vintage shopping. I love it. It really, I feel like, represents who I am, and I love the clothes. But I did a music video a while back where there was a dress I wanted to wear, and the OCD was telling me that it was creepy, the pattern was creepy, and that if I wore it, there's something called magical thinking with OCD, and I don't know if this is exactly it. But, like, okay, if I wore this dress in the music video and the song was about my life and my childhood and stuff, then it was going to somehow ruin my childhood and put like a creepy layer over everything.
Yeah.
And then I would regret it for the rest of my life. Unfortunately, that time I let the OCD win. I didn't wear the dress. I chickened out that I really wanted to wear. I threw together an outfit at the last minute for the video that I kind of hate. And what I learned from that experience, so I chose the safe outfit, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Like, there's no such thing as a safe outfit, because now it drives me crazy that I didn't wear what I wanted to wear in my own freaking music video. Like, my art, OCD robbed that from me, because it said it was creepy and it was going to do some stupid thing that doesn't even make sense. But, like,
yeah.
You know, like I said, OCD will grasp onto anything. So now I don't really like that music video. I hate the outfit that I wore, and it really makes me sad and it bums me out that I let it win. But I learned a really valuable lesson, is that caving to the OCD and doing the safe thing is not what you're supposed to do, because I didn't win. Now I have a music video with an outfit, like a safe outfit that I don't even like. So how is that winning? Like, if I know that if I had just worn the quote unquote creepy dress that I loved, I would have loved the music video. Once it's done, you stop obsessing about it, because OCD has nothing to feed off of. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%.
So I was so mad that I'd robbed something so dear to me. It's like my like art.
Yeah.
In that moment, I was like, I will never cave to you again. Mm-hmm. And I was so pissed off. So it was a really valuable learning experience to me.
I like how you talk about OCD and you say, rather than saying my OCD, you say the OCD. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that's something that you consciously do. Is maybe something you learned in your therapy, that to separate it from yourself like that?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I do say my OCD, because it's like, yes, it is a part of who I am for sure. Like, it's been a part of my life, like I said, for 25 years now. It's a part of my life that tries to like steal my like light and my joy. And like I said, what I love and what is most dear to me. So yeah, I think maybe because of that, sometimes I just try to refer to it as the OCD, because it's at odds with me being happy. Like, when I cave to it, it's a dark force. It's not, OCD doesn't want me to be happy. It doesn't want me to live a good life. It wants to rob all that from me. Every time I'm approached with a trigger, you know, it feels real and it feels scary. But over time, you start to trust the process and know that if you do what you're supposed to do and you do the scary thing, like, it will work. But still, there's still always a part of you that goes, well, what if this time it doesn't? What if this ruins your life? What if you're still thinking about this on your deathbed?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to ruin everything.
When were you in the hospitalization program, the treatment center? How long ago was that?
That was about 5 years ago. And it was actually in this very rocking chair. This is the rocking chair that I rocked my babies in, and it was a partial hospitalization program. So it was 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and I was in it for 3 months. Everyone in the program together, we were all on our laptops, but we would still like see each other in group meetings. It was still very effective and really wonderful, even though it was virtual.
And what would you say is the one thing that really was the turning point, maybe in learning about the treatment and the aha moment? Did you have that?
Well, the OCD had really taken on a lot of different stages and different stuff, morphed into different monsters and triggers throughout the years. I'll talk about one thing specifically. I'd say about maybe 11 or 12 years ago, I briefly rented an apartment, a shared apartment in Echo Park. And the first time I looked at the place, it gave me the heebie-jeebies, but it was like cheap and it looked good on paper. So I ignored that feeling and I went ahead and moved in. Very quickly regretted it. I just totally got the creeps from this place, like the ultimate creeps. That's never really happened to me before. Felt totally spooked out and it really freaked me out so badly and really was very triggering to the OCD. So basically within a week I had moved out. The whole ordeal was incredibly stressful, incredibly time-consuming, exhausting, expensive. I ended up losing a ton of money because I was doing all of these really extreme compulsions. Any furniture that had been in that apartment, I didn't want anything to do with. I felt like it was contaminated with like bad energy. So I either like donated everything to Goodwill or I threw it away. And I mean, there was stuff in there that I really like loved, like clothing that I loved, furniture that was like family heirlooms. So from an outside perspective, that seems like insane. But I didn't even want to like touch the stuff. I didn't want it to come with me into a new house. When I did move in with my now husband into our home, one of the sofas ended up in the house and I tried not to sit on it, but then sometimes I would be like brave and I would sit on it, but then I would felt like whatever I was wearing on that sofa that was contaminated, and then I would have to wash it a million times. I once hired a Reiki healer to come and try to like take the bad energy out of the sofa. That didn't work. I still felt like it was insane. And I'm saying like, I'm spending hundreds of dollars. I can't afford this. You're like a slave to your OCD when you're feeding it.
Yeah. It also sounds like there's a very firm no, no matter what. Like it's almost like a stop sign that just says you're not getting past this.
Yeah. But that whole thing lasted a long time. And I felt like there was items that were contaminated in my house. And then when I was pregnant with my daughter, I went off medication. And that was, you know, obviously disruptive to my mental health. And there was hormone changes, a lot of stress in my life. And that was a breaking point because I was like, I was getting really pregnant and I didn't have the energy anymore to be performing these compulsions. Like I didn't have the time or energy. And I was like, I need to take care of my mental health because I'm going to be a mom and I have to take care of a child. So that's when I was finally brave enough for the first time to do the exposure and response prevention.
Yeah.
Before I was like, why would I want to like go rub my body against a piece of furniture that I think has like bad energy on it? That was when I finally decided to do that. And then during the postpartum period, that can cause, that's obviously a lot of hormone changes. That was a really difficult time for me as well. And that's when it got so bad that I knew I needed a much higher level of care. Of course, I was afraid it wasn't going to work, you know? But I spent 3 months in it. I felt really supported with a bunch of other people that had OCD that all looked different. All of our OCDs were totally different.
Yeah.
And unique and bizarre in their own way. And after that program, it was still a struggle for a while. But one of the things you have to do with OCD, like my therapist says, you learn to live with the discomfort. The goal isn't to get rid of the intrusive thoughts. It's not to get rid of the discomfort. It's learning to live with it. And that is the path to setting you free. Like once you accept the discomfort and living with that, then ironically, eventually it does start to get better because you kind of just stop fighting it.
You've always talked about mental health to a certain degree in your music. And you just released a single that's specifically about OCD, Six Shades of Grey. I'm wondering what it was like to write that song, being it that was like really coming forward and being very vulnerable, whereas before it was kind of this issue that was in your songs that not so overtly.
Yeah. So I actually have two songs that I wrote during that period, which was kind of that breaking point period of like postpartum, really intensified OCD. One of them ended up being on a Deep Valley record. So the other one is called Give Me a Sign, and it's on the Deep Valley record called Marriage. I originally wrote it and was going to maybe put it on a solo record, but I ended up using it for Deep Valley. And then Six Shades of Grey was written around that same time. And I was in the midst of this really, really intense OCD episode that just seemed to keep going on forever because I couldn't get a handle on it. So it was all consuming. I mean, if you ask any of my best friends or family members, it's all I talked about at the time. I mean, I was totally feeding the compulsion. I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing. I was like caving to it. I was obsessed, and I was like talking about this thing constantly, that it was like driving everyone else crazy, you know, but everyone else like felt bad and wanted to support me and didn't really know how to support me. So I was writing songs about it. And when I released Give Me a Sign with Deep Valley, I never talked about that that's what it was about. I didn't talk about OCD openly at the time. With Six Shades of Grey, I would just open up about it for the first time because, you know, I'm 39 years old. I'm comfortable with who I am. I have a family. I have two kids. I have a husband. Like, all my best. Anyone who loves me and, like, knows me knows about my OCD. They've all experienced it firsthand. They've seen the bizarre behaviors. They've seen the episodes. So I just feel like, what's the point of, like, hiding it anymore? Especially when the song is so explicitly about that. I may as well just talk about it and raise awareness about the issue.
Yeah, and writing the song maybe and performing it would be exposure therapy in itself.
Yeah. Honestly, doing this podcast today is exposure therapy. Like, me talking about the spooky apartment and all that stuff is really triggering for me. And I even feel superstitious talking about it. Like, oh, well, now it's recorded and it's there forever. And this recording's going to be there forever. Like, anything that's permanent and can't go away, then I'm like, well, it has to be, you know, it's going to be there forever and I'll never be able to change it.
So how are you doing now with having done this interview?
Yeah, I mean, the OCD, I'm sure, will be like, oh, that will throw intrusive thoughts in my head. Like, you shouldn't have talked about that, or something bad's going to happen. But then you just have to, like, learn to sit with those thoughts. My therapist taught me the best way to deal with it will be like, not to be like, no, it won't, because that's like reassurance. You can either like agree with it or be like, okay, well, maybe it will. Like, maybe it will ruin the rest of my life. Oh, okay, well, maybe we'll see. Or it can be like, come get me. Like, see what you got, OCD.
That was my conversation with Lindsay Troy, lindsaytroy.com. For more episodes of Screen Therapy, go to screentherapyhq.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Screen Therapy book is available now. Screen Therapy, A Punk Journey Through Mental Health, tells my story and the stories of others who use punk as a catalyst for mental health. Like this podcast, it links the community-minded punk scene with the mental wellness of the punks who belong to it. To order the book, go to screentherapyhq.com. For merch, check out screentherapy.threadless.com. Okay, enough promoting. It's time for some thanking. Thank you for listening to Screen Therapy. Doing this podcast and talking to folks about punk rock and mental health has been a crucial part of my own mental stability, and it means so much to me that you're out there listening. Screen Therapy is created in the Cathet region of coastal British Columbia, Canada, on the traditional territory of the Klahaman Nation. Contact me at screentherapyhq.com or email me at screentherapypodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let's talk about punk rock and mental health. Until next time, take care and be well.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
And now, stay tuned for Tim and the Gang on Maximum Rock and Roll.